With the election of President Barack Obama, the problem of torture has not, as many of us had hoped, simply disappeared, wiped away by some of those new executive orders. Instead, it has now entered into a particularly sordid phase called impunity. Simply put, impunity is the political process of legalizing an illegal act, torture. These processes that produce impunity are complex, even convoluted. For once a state, such as the United States, willfully transgresses its own laws to torture, it twists itself into a knot of legal contradictions from which there is no easy end or exit. And whilst physical torture is difficult enough to punish, psychological torture has some distinctive, little understood attributes that makes it both resistant to prosecution or prohibition and conducive, particularly conducive, to the politics of impunity. To explain how and why this troubling past is still very much a part of our political present, let me offer, as an historian, a short history of psychological torture divided into five parts: discovery, propagation, perfection, legalization, and now impunity. Part one, discovery. On April 28, 2004, Americans were stunned when CBS television broadcast those now notorious photographs from Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison showing hooded Iraqis stripped naked while U.S. soldiers stood by smiling. As this scandal grabbed headlines around the globe, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld insisted the abuses were, quote, perpetrated by a small number of U.S. military, whom the conservative New York Times columnist William Safire soon branded as creeps. These photos are not, however, snapshots of a simple brutality or a breakdown in military discipline. Take, for example, that most iconic photo of them all, of a hooded Iraqi standing on a box with electrical wires hanging from his arms with a hood over his head. This shows not the sadism of a few creeps, but instead the two key trademarks of CIA psychological torture. The hood is for sensory disorientation. The arms are extended for self-inflicted pain. In short, this photo is a snapshot of a distinctively American form of torture, psychological torture. Viewed historically, the Abu Ghraib scandal is the product of a deeply contradictory U.S. policy toward torture since the start of the Cold War back in the 1950s. Publicly at the United Nations, Washington opposed torture and advocated a universal standard of human rights, manifest in the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948 and the Geneva Conventions of 1949. Simultaneously and secretly, however, the CIA began developing and propagating ingenious new torture techniques in contravention of these same international conventions. From 1950 to 1962, the CIA led a secret research effort to crack the code of human consciousness, a veritable Manhattan Project of the mind with costs that reach at peak $1 billion a year. During this decade, CIA mind control research moved through two distinct phases. First, an in-house CIA exploration of exotic techniques such as hypnosis and hallucinogenic drugs. And later, a focus on more mundane behavioral experimentation subcontracted to some of the most brilliant behavioral scientists of their generation. Now, while this agency drug testing led nowhere except to lawsuits, CIA-funded behavioral experiments outsourced to the continent's leading universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, McGill, produced two key findings that contributed to the discovery of psychological torture. Discovery number one, sensory deprivation. In the early 1950s, famed Canadian psychologist Dr. Donald O. Hebb found that he could induce a state akin to psychosis in just 48 hours. Now, what had the doctor done? Drugs? Hypnosis? Electroshock? None of the above. For 2 days, student volunteers at McGill University, where Dr. Hebb was chair of psychology, simply sat in a comfortable air-conditioned cubicle deprived of sensory stimulation by goggles, gloves, and earmuffs. Dr. Hebb himself reported that after just 2 or 3 days of such isolation, quote, the subject's very identity began to disintegrate. Discovery number two, self-inflicted pain. During the 1950s as well, two eminent neurologists at Cornell University Medical Center, working for the CIA, found that the KGB's most devastating torture technique involved not crude physical beatings, but simply forcing the victim to stand immobile for days at a time while the legs swell, the skin erupted in separating lesions, the kidneys shut down, hallucinations began. After a decade of this secret mind control research, in 1963, the CIA codified its findings in a succinct, secret instructional handbook, the QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual, which became the basis for a new method of psychological torture disseminated worldwide and within the U.S. intelligence community. If genius is the discovery of the obvious, then the CIA's development of this no-touch torture was a counterintuitive breakthrough, the first real revolution in the cruel science of pain in centuries. Through more than 2,000 years of Western judicial torture, the same problem had persisted. The strong defied the pain, while the weak blurted out whatever was necessary to stop it. Everything we have learned about torture in the past two millennia can be summarized in an axiom by the 3rd century Roman jurist, a man named Ulpian, and I quote, "For many persons have such strength of body and soul that they heed the pain very little, so that there is no means of obtaining the truth from them, while others are so susceptible to pain that they will tell any lie rather than suffer it." Now, by contrast, the CIA's psychological paradigm fused these new methods, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, whose combination would, in theory, cause victims to feel responsible for their own suffering and thus capitulate more readily, more fully, to their inquisitors. Refined through years of practice, the CIA's use of sensory disorientation relies on seemingly banal procedures, heat and cold, light and dark, noise and silence, feast and famine, for a systematic attack on the sensory pathways into the human mind. In its clandestine journey across continents and decades, this distinctively American form of psychological torture would prove elusive, inventive, powerfully seductive, and devastatingly destructive. Let's review in brief each attribute, since they are the key, at least for me, to understanding psychological torture. First, elusive. Unlike its physical variant, psychological torture lacks any clear signs of abuse, any sequelae, and easily eludes detection, greatly complicating any investigation, prosecution, or attempt at prohibition. After being trained by British intelligence, who developed this doctrine in conjunction with the CIA back in the 1950s, the Royal Ulster Constabulary applied these methods on IRA suspects in Belfast in 1971, prompting a British parliamentary inquiry by Lord Parker of Waddington that found these psychological techniques complicated any determination of torture. Where, Lord Parker asked in his report to Parliament, does hardship and discomfort end, and for instance, humiliating treatment begin? And where does the latter end and torture begin? The answer, he said, turns on words of definition, and thus opinions will inevitably differ. Note that phrase, that key phrase, that prescient phrase, words of definition. Next, inventive. In the 40 years since its discovery, the agency's psychological paradigm has proved surprisingly inventive, with each sustained application producing innovation. Since innovation is not accidental, but the result of scientific research and systematic application at each stage in this, it has been central at each stage of this doctrine's evolution. Discovery in the 1950s, dissemination in the 1980s, and rediscovery since 2001. Third, seductive. For both the perpetrators and the powerful who command them, torture seems to have a seductive psychological appeal, whether assuaging insecurity in times of crisis or arousing a darkly erotic sense of empowerment. In 1956, those two distinguished cognitive scientists working for the CIA described torture's appeal in words equally applicable to the Kremlin or the White House. Quote, "When feelings of insecurity develop within those holding power, they become increasingly suspicious and put great pressures upon the secret police to obtain arrests and confessions. At such times, police officials are inclined to condone anything which produces a speedy confession, and brutality may become widespread." Even after torture is initially intended for a few Soviet spies or a few top Al-Qaeda commanders, it soon spreads uncontrollably in two directions: rapid proliferation of the torture of the many and an inexorable escalation in the scale of brutality. So strong is torture's appeal to the powerful that they will always concoct rationales to preserve their prerogative of torture in defiance of all evidence of ineffectiveness in interrogation and its enormously high political costs. Fourth and finally, destructive. Although seemingly less brutal than physical methods, The CIA's no-touch torture actually leaves searing psychological scars. Victims often need long treatment to recover from a trauma that many experts consider more crippling than physical pain. Indeed, in a study of 432 torture survivors published in 2009, Dr. Metin Basoglu of King's College London concluded that, quote, "The inhuman and degrading treatment were the major determinants of a lasting psychological damage in detainees. This indicated the need for a broader definition beyond, quote, a rather stereotypical image of torture as involving only certain atrocious acts of physical violence." Again, note that phrase, a broader definition. As we move quickly through the history of CIA psychological torture over the past 40 years, we will note how these four key attributes, elusive, inventive, seductive, and destructive, recur time and again to delineate distinctive American doctrine of psychological torture. Part two, propagating the paradigm. After codification of the 1963 Kubark Manual, the CIA spent the next 30 years propagating these torture techniques within the U.S. intelligence community and among anti-communist allies across Asia and Latin America. The CIA applied these techniques in South Vietnam under the Phoenix Program with methods that soon escalated and became brutally physical, producing some 40,000 extrajudicial executions. In a 1983 training manual, the CIA taught Honduran military interrogators that they should, quote, "manipulate the subject's environment to create intolerable situations to disrupt patterns of time, space, and sensory perception." In short, a total assault on the sensory pathways to the extrasensual platform of human identity. These techniques in this 1983 manual seem strikingly similar to those outlined 20 years earlier in the CIA's Kubark manual and those that would be used 20 years later at Abu Ghraib. When the Cold War came to a close, Washington resumed its advocacy of human rights, ratifying the UN Convention Against Torture in 1994 that banned the infliction of both severe psychological and physical pain. Now, on the surface, by the ratification of this convention, the United States seemed to have resolved the tension between its anti-torture principles and its secret torture practices. But when President Clinton sent this UN convention to Congress for ratification in 1994, he included verbatim, unchanged, language drafted 6 years before by the Reagan administration, language that had four detailed diplomatic reservations focused on just one word in the 26 printed pages of this UN convention. That word was mental. Instead of the UN's broad language about severe pain or suffering, these American reservations narrowed the standard for psychological torture by requiring prolonged mental harm caused by just four specific acts. Let me quote these four specific criteria for what constitutes, in an American view, psychological torture. Quote, one, the intentional infliction of severe physical pain or suffering. Two, the administration of mind-altering substances. Three, the threat of imminent death. Or four, the threat that another person will immediately be subjected to death, end quote. Now, under this legal definition, any form of abuse apart from these four very specific techniques is not psychological torture. Quite cleverly, these modest reservations eviscerated the UN Convention and granted legal immunity to perpetrators of psychological torture by first changing the UN's specific standard of severe pain to an ill-defined prolonged mental harm. How long is prolonged? Three seconds. In the midst of my rapid-fire delivery, that probably seemed prolonged. Okay, so how long is prolonged? Next, limiting the UN's broad causality to just four specific methods, quoted above. And finally, and very importantly, shifting the UN's focus on the victim's suffering as the determinant of torture to the perpetrator's subjective perception of intention in inflicting that suffering. Thus, these intricately constructed diplomatic reservations redefine torture, at least for the United States, to exclude sensory deprivation and self-inflicted pain, the very psychological techniques the CIA had refined at such great cost. This definition was reproduced verbatim in domestic legislation enacted to give legal force to the UN Convention. First, in Section 2340 of the U.S. Federal Code, then in the War Crimes Act of 1996, and then the expanded War Crimes Act of 1997. In effect, Washington had split the UN Convention down the middle, banning physical torture but exempting psychological abuse. A year later, in 1995, when the Clinton administration launched its covert campaign against Al-Qaeda, the CIA avoided direct involvement in torture by sending some 70 terrorist suspects to allied nations notorious for brutal physical torture, a practice called extraordinary rendition, supposedly banned by the UN Convention. By failing to repudiate the CIA's use of torture, while adopting a UN convention that condemned its practice, the United States left this contradiction buried like a political landmine, ready to detonate with such phenomenal force just 10 years later in the Abu Ghraib scandal. Part 3, the perfection of psychological torture. Right after his public address to a shaken nation on September 11, 2001, President Bush gave his White House staff secret orders saying, quote, "I don't care what the international lawyers say, we are going to kick some ass," end quote. In the months that followed, administration attorneys translated their president's eloquent but otherwise unlawful orders into U.S. policy through three controversial neoconservative legal doctrines. One, the president is above the law. Two, torture is legally acceptable. And three, the U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo Bay is not U.S. territory. In their now notorious August 2002 memos, Assistant Attorney General Jay Bybee and his associate John Yoo concluded that pain equivalent to organ failure was legal, effectively allowing torture right up to the point of death. Further up the chain of command, a top national security team led by Vice President Cheney, Attorney General Ashcroft, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, met regularly in the White House Situation Room from 2002 to 2004 to authorize abuse such as sleep deprivation, wall slamming, and waterboarding. After watching CIA employees pantomime what Condoleezza Rice called, quote, "certain physical and psychological interrogation techniques," these leaders, their imagination stimulated by graphic visions of human suffering, repeatedly authorized extreme psychological techniques stiffened by hitting, walling, and waterboarding. Even after CBS exposed Abu Ghraib in April 2004, this committee met again to approve yet more CIA torture, illustrating, in my view, its seductive appeal to the powerful that often overwhelms rationality. As it took off the metaphoric gloves, the White House authorized the CIA to build a global network of 8 secret prisons, the so-called black sites, located in allied nations from Thailand to Poland. Now, without clear guidelines or close supervision during their first year of these operations, 2002 to 2003, these CIA black sites became a kind of lurid guignol of what the agency's own inspector general later called, quote, "unauthorized, improvised, inhumane, and undocumented interrogation techniques." Reflecting torture's inexorable escalation in the scale of brutality, the CIA inspector general later found that these improvised actions range from the cruel to the possibly criminal, including strangling with both hands to restrict the detainee's carotid artery, staging mock execution by firing handguns, confining a detainee in a cold room shackled naked, racking an unloaded automatic pistol and revving a power drill close to the detainee's head, threatening through an Arabic interpreter to begin sexually abusing female relatives in front of the detainee, telling a high-level prisoner, "we're going to kill your children." After CIA headquarters issued clear guidelines in January 2003, such experimentation soon ended, and agency interrogation followed a strict roster of 10 enhanced techniques designed by agency psychologists, including waterboarding, a particularly cruel method that replicates drowning. Now, here we might ask whether waterboarding is a perfectly legal enhanced technique, just a little dunk of water, as Vice President Cheney once called it, or whether waterboarding is so cruel that it constitutes torture. After French paratroopers tortured him with this technique during the Battle of Algiers in 1957, a French colonial journalist named Henri Allègue wrote a moving description of this method in a book that turned France against torture and indeed the Algerian War. Quote, I tried by contracting my throat to take in as little water as possible and to resist suffocation by keeping air in my lungs for as long as I could, but I couldn't hold on for more than a few moments. I had the impression of drowning, and a terrible agony, that of death itself, took possession of me. Let's think a little bit about the deeper meaning of Aleg's very sparse words, a terrible agony, that of death itself. Although written years before science discovered this cognitive reflex, Aleg's words were an eerily accurate adumbration of something called the mammalian diving reflex, a deep-seated fear of drowning hardwired into the human mind in ways that allows infants to survive drowning in cold water, not for 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but 20 full minutes, and to emerge not only alive, but without any brain damage. As waterboarding blocks air to the lungs, the human organism's powerful mammalian diving reflex kicks in, and the brain is racked by horrifically painful panic signals, death, death, death. Then the victim vomits out water, the lungs suck air, the panic subsides, and then it happens again and again and again and again, inscribing the searing trauma of near death in human memory and producing one of the most extreme forms of pain imaginable, the visceral fear of death itself, the ultimate fear, the one fear that none of us can ever truly conquer. Instead of this crude French method, however, the CIA refined waterboarding by building a special gurney with the perfect angle to flood the lungs with water, using a saline solution as well to avoid death by hyponatremia from excessive ingestion of water, and allowing interrogators 3 applications of water every hour. We now know from those recently released Justice Department memos that CIA interrogators used this extreme method to waterboard Al-Qaeda captive Abu Zubaydah at least 83 times in a single month, August 2002, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times in March 2003, an excess best explained, in my view, by the seductive appeal of psychological torture. Adding another strand to this research effort, in late 2002, Defense Secretary Mumsfeld appointed General Jeffrey Miller to command Guantanamo with wide latitude for interrogation, making this prison into an ad hoc behavioral science laboratory. Under General Miller, Guantanamo's interrogators stiffened the psychological assault by exploring Arab cultural sensitivities, sexuality, gender identity, and fear of dogs. General Miller also formed behavioral science consultation teams of military psychologists who probed each detainee for individual phobias, such as fear of dark or attachment to mother. Through this 3-phase attack on sensory receptors, cultural identity, and individual psyche, Guantanamo's innovation perfected the CIA's psychological paradigm. Significantly, after regular inspections of Guantanamo from 2002 to 2004, the International Red Cross called this interrogation, quote, an intentional system of cruel, unusual, and degrading treatment and a form of torture. After a visit from Guantanamo Chief General Miller in September 2003, the U.S. Commander for Iraq, General Ricardo Sanchez, issued orders for a sophisticated psychological torture. As I read from General Sanchez's orders, please listen for the combination of these 3 key techniques, sensory disorientation, self-inflicted pain, and that recent innovation, cultural humiliation. U, environmental manipulation, altering the environment to create moderate discomfort, e.g. adjusting temperatures. V, sleep adjustment, adjusting the sleeping times of the detainee, reversing the sleeping cycles from night to day. Isolation, isolating the detainee from other detainees for 30 days. Y, presence of military working dogs, exploits Arab fear of dogs while maintaining security. AA, yelling, loud music and light control, used to create fear, disorient detainee, and prolong capture shock. CC, stress positions, use of physical posturing, sitting, standing, kneeling, prone. It is no accident that Private Lindy England was so famously photographed leading an Iraqi detainee leashed like a dog. Beyond these black sites, these abusive techniques proliferated virally. After Secretary Rumsfeld ordered harsh interrogation at Guantanamo, word spread rapidly down the chain of command. Across Iraq in 2004-2005, the military's Joint Special Operations Command operated 5 field interrogation centers where detainees were subjected to sensory deprivation, beating, burning, electric shock, and waterboarding, systematic abuse that later led to 34 convictions before military tribunals. Part 4, legalization of psychological torture. Confronted by public anger after the expose of detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib, the Bush White House fought back by defending torture as a presidential prerogative. On September 6, 2006, in a dramatic bid to legalize his now illegal practices in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's Hamdan decision, President Bush announced that he was sending legislation to Congress that would legalize the same presidential prerogatives over detainees challenged by the Supreme Court. After tense day-long negotiations inside Vice President Cheney's Senate office on September 21st, Republican partisans drafted legislation that sailed through Congress without amendment or alteration to become the Military Commissions Act 2006. Buried deep inside this law's 38 pages of dense print, Cheney included clauses defining serious physical pain as, quote, pay attention here, you've heard these words, significant loss or impairment of the function of a bodily member, organ, or mental failure, mental faculty. Significant loss or impairment of the function of a bodily member, organ, or mental faculty. We've heard that before. This is a striking paraphrase of John Yoo's absolutely notorious definition of physical torture as pain, quote, equivalent to organ failure. This language was so outrageous that it had already been repudiated by Bush's Justice Department, but it now was and is the law of this land. Above all, the Military Commissions Act 2006 protected the CIA's use of psychological torture by repeating verbatim that exculpatory language still embedded in Section 2340 of the Federal Code that limits the definition of psychological abuse to just four specific acts: intentional infliction of severe pain, drugs, death threats, or threats of death against another. If you wish an analogy to make the almost absurdly but very clever exclusionary logic of this legislation perfectly clear, it would be as if U.S. homicide law had taken a leaf from the popular board game Clue, we all know Clue, don't we, and defined murder, here's my favorite, as only those killings done by Mrs. White in the conservatory with the candlestick, thereby legalizing all murders done by more conventional methods such as poison, pistols, rifles, knives, ropes, clubs, bombs, defenestration, automobile, you name it. This law simultaneously preserved the president's prerogative of torture while laying the legal foundations for a later impunity once Bush left office. In sum, by these words of definition, this law legalizes an illegal act, psychological torture. Part 5, where we are now, impunity in America. Not only were the Bush administration's lawyers aggressive in their advocacy of torture, they were meticulous right from the start in laying the legal groundwork for a later impunity for crimes of torture. Empowered by their dominion over pain and pleasure, life and death, torturers the world over show no shame, feel no remorse, and play upon the levers of state power to escape any culpability for their crimes. No matter how twisted the politics might be, the process of impunity, whether in England, France, Indonesia, the Philippines, or America, usually passes through three stages. First, blame the supposed bad apples. Second, invoke national security, saying something like, these methods protected us. Third, appeal to national unity, saying, we need to put the past behind us because we need to move forward together. To these three, we must add an uncommon fourth stage, found most visibly in Indonesia and America, a political counterattack by perpetrators and their protectors who attack, who chastise human rights reformers for somehow weakening the nation's security. Let's see how we have moved step by step toward impunity for torture in the months since President Obama took office. First, blame the bad apples. For a year after the Abu Ghraib expose, Donald Rumsfeld's Pentagon blamed the bad apples by claiming the abuse was, to quote again, perpetrated by a small number of U.S. military. In his statement of May 2009, refusing to release more torture photos, President Obama echoed Secretary Rumsfeld, saying the abuse in these latest images, which he was not releasing, quote, was carried out in the past by a small number of individuals. Second, invoke national security. In the months following Obama's inauguration, Republicans have taken us deep into the second stage of impunity, with former President Vice Cheney's statements that the CIA's methods, quote, prevented the violent deaths of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people, a claim that the Obama administration has not disputed directly. Third, appeal to unity. In the first months of his administration, President Obama tried to adopt a balanced approach towards these sensitive security issues, addressing past excesses while trying to avoid a divisive debate over past policies. Right after his inauguration, President Obama, as we all know, announced correctives to the most controversial of Bush's policies, closing the CIA black sites, ordering that the agency interrogation comply with the Army's field manual, and working to transfer detainees from Guantanamo. But in his attempt to preempt a political backlash over these measures, President Obama brought us to the third and, in most cases, final stage of impunity when he visited CIA headquarters in April 2009 and promised there would be no investigation or prosecution of agency employees, saying, quote, "We've made some mistakes, but it's time to acknowledge them and then move forward." When the Senate Judiciary Committee Chair, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, called for an independent commission on interrogation, the White House announced that, quote, "The president determined the concept didn't seem altogether workable," end quote. Fourth, political counterattack. By failing to investigate past human rights abuse, President Obama seems inadvertently to have created a political opening for an additional stage in the process of impunity, a political counterattack by perpetrators seeking not just impunity, but vindication. Only days after the abortive bomb attempt on a Northwest Airlines flight near Detroit last December, Liz Cheney, daughter of the vice president, launched her hyper-patriotic group, Keep America Safe, blasting Obama for letting the Justice Department, quote, "investigate CIA officials who kept us safe after 9/11, or punish the lawyers who provided the legal framework for programs that saved American lives," end quote. Liz Cheney's group also has also charged that the president, quote, "has compromised American security by refusing to use every tool at his disposal to prevent attacks." So, we might ask, what is the missing tool the president is not using? Dick Cheney himself soon identified that missing tool, telling ABC News that the CIA should have been allowed to waterboard that Detroit underpants bomber, and calling Obama's orders that the agency comply with the Army field manual, quote, "a mistake." This rising drumbeat of thunder from the Republican right has pushed Obama towards a compromised position on human rights. Just weeks after this media mauling by the Cheney father-daughter tag team, Obama's Justice Department reversed an earlier ruling that Bush lawyers Jay Bybee and John Yoo had been, quote, "guilty of professional misconduct" in writing that 2002 organ failure memo that gave the CIA a wide authority for abuse. But now, justice found that Bybee and Yoo had merely acted from, quote, "a sincerely held view of executive power," thereby exempting them from any threat of disbarment, just as the Cheneys, father and daughter, had demanded. Battered by these attacks from the right, the Obama administration has retreated from its original commitment to human rights, canceling the New York terror trials, authorizing detention without trial for terror suspects, retaining the controversial military commissions, allowing Special Operations Command to operate secret prisons in Afghanistan and Iraq, and retaining Bush's revised Army interrogation manual, which permits extreme psychological abuse. By the end of 2009, a spokesman for the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, Jamil Jaffer, could justly offer a dismal assessment of these trends, saying, quote, "The Bush administration constructed a legal framework for torture, but the Obama administration is constructing a legal framework for impunity," end quote. This process of impunity has pushed Washington back towards the contradictory torture policy that we saw at the outset, the policy that Washington adopted during the Cold War, that is, publicly advocating human rights while covertly outsourcing torture to allied governments. In retrospect, it now seems clear that the main aberration of the Bush years lay not in torture per se, but in President Bush's order that the CIA should operate its own torture prisons and agents, American agents, to dirty their hands with waterboarding and wall slamming. Backed by the White House, Obama's new CIA director, Leon Panetta, at the time of his confirmation, announced that the agency would continue to engage in the rendition of terrorist suspect to allies like Libya, Pakistan, or Saudi Arabia, where, of course, we can rely on diplomatic assurances of good treatment. Throughout this long, divisive debate over torture, the elusive nature of psychological torture, epitomized by former Vice President Cheney's iconic argument about waterboarding as that little dunk in the water, has facilitated the slide into an interminable impunity. Let's now close by reflecting briefly on this sad history. If history repeats itself not as tragedy but as farce, then this revival of CIA Cold War torture for the war on terror has been so unnecessary that it was and is almost farcical. Just as the CIA's psychological protocol has become a distinctively American form of torture, so there's an alternative American approach towards interrogation that we might call empathetic interrogation, which is quick, reliable, and completely legal. From 1942 to 2002, a period of 60 years, the FBI controlled counterintelligence operations for the United States. After World War II, using this method quite successfully to investigate threats to our domestic security. For example, after the bombing of U.S. Embassy in East Africa in 1998, FBI teams interrogated captured terrorists, gained some of our best intelligence on Al-Qaeda, and won convictions of all the accused in U.S. federal courts. But when President Bush transferred control of all Al-Qaeda captives from the FBI to the CIA in early 2002, and counterintelligence operations from the Bureau to the agency, experienced FBI interrogators would spend the next 6 years complaining bitterly that the CIA's coercive methods actually blocked their effective interrogation. Indeed, in 2004, the CIA's own Inspector General conducted a careful review of operations inside the agency's black sites and concluded that there was no evidence that these so-called enhanced techniques had actually worked. Indeed, the former FBI interrogator Ali Sofan has argued from his own experience inside those same CIA black sites that all the real intelligence gained came from non-coercive interrogation. In short, both the FBI and CIA now tell us that torture does not work in getting accurate information. Yet this process of political impunity, compounded by the elusive nature of psychological torture, has preserved both the executive's prerogative of torture and the political will to use it. Unless some formal inquiry, akin to that proposed by Senator Patrick Leahy, breaks this cycle of deceit, expose, and political paralysis, we're likely, in a few years hence, to find ourselves right back where we are now, mired and yet again in another painful politics of impunity. For so seductive is the appeal of torture, whether physical or psychological, that any tolerance for the practice, no matter how slight, will almost inexorably climb the scale of brutality or spread to the torture of the many. In my view, there is no such thing as a little bit of torture. In my view, there is no such thing as a little dunk of water. As a powerfully symbolic state practice, synonymous throughout history with brutal autocrats, such a recurrence of torture, even of the few, even of just one human being, will once again raise the most profound moral questions about the quality of America's justice, the character of its civilization, and the legitimacy of its global leadership. Only next time, the consequences of such a scandal, of such a revelation for this nation's international reputation will be, I feel, much, much worse. Thank you. Thank you. Usually the only time I get a standing ovation is right before the final exam when the students are hoping for mercy. So I think that this is probably my first genuine standing ovation in my entire career.
We think we've got about 20 minutes for questions. So we have microphones that are set up here in the front. So if you have a question, please come forward and maybe we can structure it so that those who come forward first and kind of in line, we can move ahead that way. So I'll turn it back over to Dr. McCoy.
Thank you.
I have a three-part question. So the first part is people who are interested in studying the military and CIA interventions come up against the government basically covering its tracks. Can you please speak to your means of research?
Sure.
And secondly, this goes along with that, how can people from civil society in the U.S. who are concerned about what's going on keep track of what's happening in max security prisons as well as overseas? Because that's also a zone of torture, as well as overseas in secret prisons where it's out of sight and really kept away from the public. And the third part of the question is, what do you think can really be the best means of advocacy for changing the current system we're in, especially with the Obama administration not taking a strong stance against eliminating these practices? I think one of our strongest arguments is that I can't imagine a stronger motive for extremist violence than images of Muslim men being sexually humiliated and tortured, that would be enough to drive many people to extreme violence.
Sure. In the interest of time, let me collapse your three questions into two. One is actually a mythological question about
how do we find out about what's going on?
Yeah, right, exactly. How can we study and know about what's going on, or how do I know and how can
Second
one
part,
know?
How do we stop?
Okay, it's difficult. That's one of the problems of relying upon a covert agency for doing some of the most important aspects of the U.S. government. If it were the military, there would be no problem. The military makes mistakes, but it has all services have an excellent judge advocate general corps that is, and have investigative, whether it's the Navy or the Army, all of them have their investigative arms. They take their work enormously seriously. And within the limits of what can be done on a battlefield, I think we're an exemplary military in the arc of human history in investigating and prosecuting and trying to correct. Indeed, one of the heroes, or in my way, of this whole debate over torture on my side of the issue have been the JAGs, both retired, serving JAGs, and then the heads of the services. They've been exemplary in standing up for the principles of their service and what I believe are the principles that are enshrined in our laws and constitution. Okay? So the problem is it's done covertly. All right, now, then how do you research this? Well, one of the things that happened after 9/11 was there was a bitter debate inside the Bush administration in which the JAGs lost. And I don't know if it was them, but by gosh and golly, suddenly all this secret documents started leaking out of them, and Karen Greenberg compiled them into a massive volume, and they're still coming out. So one of the ways that American democracy operates is when there's a debate, the losing side often leaks. And those now with the internet, there's more leaks than ever before. And so the documents leaked out and they became available. A second way of researching is to look at victims' testimony when they describe their experiences and just look for patterns in the kind of torture. And look for, if you will, counterintuitive patterns. For example, one of the reasons that I was able to study psychological torture in a number of settings, I started this in the Philippines, was that looking at military officers who graduated from military academy where they were brutally hazed physically to the point where young cadets often die in the Philippine military academy of their hazing. Take a perfectly healthy 18-year-old male, they don't do it to females, and beat them to death. Okay? They emerged from this experience, and they were using sophisticated psychological techniques when you think their default is military physical guys who were beaten when they would beat, but they didn't. And there was a pattern to their techniques, and there was a pattern that recurred in Latin America. And you can begin to see this counterintuitive pattern cropping up, and it was quite consistent. And so that from the victim's testimony, you're able to often get the structure of the operations, the mentality of the military structure. The next question is what to do. We have not been idle, okay? Although I was, my talk is necessarily on the pessimistic side of things, let's look at how far we've come. In the early days after 9/11, the Bush administration, with the support of the Republicans in Congress and much of the American people, adopted these extreme and illegal techniques. Over time, first of all, they emerged from the bureaucracy. People started leaking. There were debates inside the administration that people like Alberto Mora, the top legal officer for the U.S. Navy, thought it was an outrage, fought it as hard as he could. There are many people inside the bureaucracy. The FBI, all right? FBI agents around the world working with CIA bombarded bureau headquarters with detailed emails appalled at what was going on, describing the human degradation in moving terms and condemning it on grounds that it wasn't working. It was screwing up their interrogation. All right? There was a huge debate. And slowly, the Professional Association of the United States, there are all kinds of human rights groups, human rights groups, Amnesty, etc., lawyers groups, some very powerful corporate law firms in New York, the professional associations, mindful of their ethical codes and responsibilities, began moving forward. And so we now have a debate, all right? The debate's not over, okay? The recite is resurgent. The left, the liberals, have been kind of quiet, thinking that well, we won the election, you know, it's over for us. No, it's not over. That's simply an invitation to another round of debate at a higher plane when we have greater opportunity for making progress. And so American democracy is never, my view, such as it might be, you know, it's not an end product, it's a process that requires constant engagement. We rebuild our democracy, we reaffirm our principles every day from across the political spectrum. If one side goes silent thinking they've got it wrapped up in one, well, the other side is going to be resurgent. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor McCoy, thank you. For two questions. Could you talk about, as we talked about before, the role of enhanced interrogation and solitary confinement as developed in the American penal carceral system over the last 100 years, and what role that plays? And secondly, a personal question. Your work on psychological torture, is it at all related to your experience of the CIA going after you for publishing work on their role in the Southeast Asia drug trafficking? You know, kind of a personal existential death threats, that kind of thing.
Well, first of all, the study of prisons is a separate study, but it's one that intersects at certain levels that are beyond my expertise. But basically, one of the issues, and Congressman McDermott mentioned it in his opening remarks, and it's a very important issue, and it's something that I think, forgive me for telling you people how you should do your business. But, you know, the conditions in our prisons, particularly conditions of solitary confinement, and particularly the mental health of the prisoners, okay, is something that, you know, needs to be engaged, all right? And let me explain why. In the early 19th century, America was a pioneer in corrective incarceration, and there were, to the best of my knowledge, and it's fragmentary, and I say all of this subject to correction. I do apologize. I wasn't prepared for this one. One was the Auburn experiment in New York, which was a very rigid physical discipline. The other was an interesting one that was regarded as pioneering around the world, which was the Philadelphia experiment. And the idea was, and I think it may have been derived from the Quaker tradition of that city, but a historian would probably correct me on that, was that a prisoner would be confined in absolute solitary confinement, almost like as a Quaker meeting, to contemplate their wayward ways and achieve enlightenment. And this attracted Charles Dickens to the United States, and it's what brought Alex de Tocqueville to America to write his famous study of American democracy. He didn't come here to study American democracy. He came here to study the Philadelphia prison experiment. It was widely copied in Europe. By the end of the 19th century, Europeans, based upon their experience of this Philadelphia experiment, discovered that it produced two things: uncontrolled anger or catatonia. People curled up in their cells, or they just were, like the term of the day, lunatics. And there was a 1891 U.S. Supreme Court decision, I wasn't ready for it, and I can't remember the name, which actually ruled on a Colorado law. Colorado passed a law saying that if you killed somebody, you would be executed. Not surprising, we're in America. but what they did was they added a unique one, that before your execution, you would be put in solitary confinement for 30 days to contemplate your crime, and then you'd go to your death enlightened and maybe meet your maker and get a better fate. I don't know what the theological aim was. But the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that, okay, you can hang him, no problem, but you can't confine him for 30 days because that's cruel and unusual punishment. Because they drew upon that European literature about the Philadelphia experiment, and they found, okay, that this was, in fact, it produced this terrible psychological outcome. And that Colorado law was ruled unconstitutional. Well, 100 years later, of course, what are we doing? In our supermax, we're confining people, 23 hours a day in total isolation? And when they get out to run around and exercise air like gerbils, they're all by themselves. Okay. If the U.S. Supreme Court could find over 120 years ago that this was cruel and unusual punishment, why does this suddenly become humane today? I don't understand this. So this is something that as medical practitioners played a central role in that earlier finding. There's now another role for this to be looked at. And there are people like Stuart Grassian and, what's his name, the psychologist at UC Santa Cruz, Greg Haney, okay, who was the research assistant in the Zimbardo prison experiments, okay. And they both work in this area. They've campaigned for reform for years as medical professionals. They just haven't gotten much traction on the issue. And so this is an unaddressed public health problem, which I think, demands greater support than Haney and Grassian and others have gotten in their campaign. The last thing, that was a question, sorry, just one last.
Sure, sure.
My personal motivation for getting into this. No, I'm a Southeast Asia specialist, and I was doing research in the Philippines in 1986 when Marcos fell from power. And I was sent there by Home Box Office to be a historical consultant in the making of what became a six-part miniseries and to write the history behind the story of Marcos's overthrow. So the heroes of the hour were these colonels who had launched a coup that they'd become a mutiny inside an army base, and they were surrounded by a million Filipinos, and that was the famous Philippine People Power Revolution. These were great heroes lionized around the world. And I began to interview them, and something wrong about it. I don't know, something strange about these guys. So I started looking into their records, and I found out that they weren't intelligence officers, and they weren't staff officers, and they weren't line officers in combat, and there was a lot of combat. They were internal security officers. They'd run the safe houses. They'd been doing the interrogation, the extrajudicial executions, something the Filipinos called salvaging from salvaje. Hispano-Filipino mean to pick somebody up, torture them, put the stigmata on their bodies, and display the remains. 2,700 people were died this way. These were the men that did that. They were Marcos's personifications of terror. And I wrote a book about this and argued that torture was a transactional experience. That, as we many people in the treatment of torture victim knows, does permanent psychological damage, almost eviscerates the human spirit unless treated. I argued that it seems to be a transactional experience. Just as the victim is destroyed, the perpetrator is empowered. And I brought that insight into that discussion of impunity where I said that, you know, in the aftermath of this experience, our perpetrators and the powerful that protected them are walking like titans on the earth, unrepentant, determined not only to get impunity, but to be vindicated.
I guess my question is mostly about the motivation of torturers and people who authorize torture. You used in your presentation words like seductive and darkly erotic, and then later answering Sunil's question, you talked about the unrepentant titans. And that to me like brings to mind cartoon images of evildoers rubbing their hands and saying, wahaha. And I think trying to understand why people do what they do, as soon as we call them evil, we can't at all understand them, because we have separated ourselves from them and think of them as different, and like we need to understand them on the basis of a common humanity. I mean, I guess I assume it has something to do with the separation of power, those who order the torture or allow it and those down the chain who perform it. But like, how do people torture and keep getting up in the morning? Like how do they keep doing it, and why do people who do know that it doesn't work still authorize it? Like, are they taken in by its dark seduction? Something's missing for me in trying to, like, they're humans doing it to other humans. Like, what?
Yep. That's a very perplexing question, and it's one that the perpetrators have generally been exempt from research. And so it's one of those, you know, there is a fragmentary, tiny fragmentary body of literature on perpetrators that doesn't usually go very deep. So what's the appeal? I mean, if I were to hypothesize, okay, I would argue that probably, you know, maybe wrong, that when we map the human mind, we would discover that the stimulus for torture lies in the same arena of the human mind that makes hard pornography, and I mean hard pornography, a $5 billion a year U.S. industry, okay, and there's this dark dimension of the human consciousness that we don't understand and explore, and I think that torture's appeal lies in that domain. The second thing about, the literature, in my own personal experience of interviewing a handful of perpetrators, they're not easy to find and interview, and the literature, I think, is best captured by Amnesty's title and the process that emerged during the Greek torture trials after the colonels fell from power in Greece. And Greece actually had a tribunal in which they put the torturers on trial. And one of those who had been convicted was an ordinary recruit. Greece had conscription. And he was prosecuted. They selected randomly, and they made some of the recruits torturers. And one of these guys, who was a brute under torture, was put before the courts, and he stood up and said to the Greek nation,
if I got it right, you know, I am your neighbor's son. Okay, and that, you know, and that to me indicates to me that, I think anybody can do this. Anybody has the capacity. Put through the training, put in the circumstances, and then once it starts, I suspect that it becomes quite seductive. It becomes like killing can be.
So you see it as like a system that just perpetuates itself and brings in...
No. It's a state apparatus or party commanding a state makes a policy decision and moves down the chain of command. Once it's put into place, once that decision has been made, then this consciousness and capacity kicks in. All right. And so the critical thing is, first of all, to enact laws that ban it. And that's why I argue that there's no, we can't do a little bit of it. Okay. The argument in America is not about we should torture as a matter of course. The argument we've had in the United States is for a little bit of torture. You know, even at the height of 9/11, you know, Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard Law professor, who was the most persuasive and articulate advocate of torture, was arguing for very qualified and conditional uses of torture. Okay? So, you know, we started off in every case, we started off, let's say, in the 1950s. We didn't plan to torture people widely. We were just looking for a method for finding out a few Soviet double agents. We wound up in the Phoenix program with 45 CIA secret prisons engaged in round-the-clock torture, with the CIA admitted to 20,000 extrajudicial executions. By the time you had the South Vietnamese, 40,000 as the apex of that process, you know, within a few years. It ramps out of control. Now, Bush administration, I don't think, had the idea that Abu Ghraib would happen. They had the idea that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would be treated with those techniques. And before you know it, Special Operations Command's got 5 prisons, CIA's got 8 black sites, Abu Ghraib is operating full tilt, it's proliferating out of control. Bagram is becoming a killing, 2 people killed in Bagram, brutal techniques right out of control. It just ramped right out of control. It sank down the chain of command and then spread. I think probably the Bush administration was probably as surprised as anybody else by Abu Ghraib. Okay, we have to, I do apologize, but we're told we have to close.
Sorry about that. We know that there are other questions out in the audience. We do have to end now. But once again, I think a very hearty round of applause for Dr. McCoy. Amazing talk.